Volume 5, Number 546, The Resurrection of Lazarus. Jesus is coming towards Bethany from En Shemesh. They must have marched really hard up the difficult paths on the Adullam Mountains. The apostles, who are out of breath, find it difficult to follow Jesus, who walks rapidly, as if love carried him on its ardent wings. A smile brightens Jesus' face as he proceeds ahead of them all, with his head raised in the mild midday sunshine. Before they arrive at the first houses of Bethany, a barefooted boy, who is going to the fountain near the village with an empty copper pitcher, sees him and gives a shout. He lays the pitcher on the ground and runs away, with all the speed of his little legs, towards the center of the village.
"He is certainly going to inform them that you are arriving," remarked Judas Thaddeus, after smiling like everybody else upon the quick decision of the little boy, who also left his pitcher at the mercy of the first passerby.
The little town, as seen from the fountain, which is a little higher up, seems quiet as if it were deserted. Only the gray smoke rising from chimneys indicates that in the houses women are busy preparing the midday meal, and the thick voices of men in the vast silent olive groves and orchards inform one that men are working. Even so, Jesus prefers to take a path that runs round the rear of the village so that he may arrive at Lazarus' house without drawing the attention of the citizens. They have gone almost halfway when they hear the boy mentioned previously come after them. He runs past them and then stops thoughtfully in the middle of the path, looking at Jesus. "Peace to you, little Mark. Were you afraid of me that you ran away?"
"No, Lord, I was not afraid. But as for many days, Martha and Mary have been sending servants on the roads leading here to see whether you were coming. When I saw you, I ran to tell them that you were coming."
"You did the right thing. The sisters will be preparing their hearts to see me."
"No, Lord, the sisters are not preparing anything, because they do not know. They would not let me tell them. They got hold of me when I entered the garden, saying, 'The rabbi's here,' and they drove me out, saying, 'You are a liar or a fool. He is not coming anymore, because he knows by now that he cannot work the miracle anymore.' And as I said that it was really you, they gave me two mighty slaps as I never had before. Look how red my cheeks are. They're smarting. And they pushed me away, saying, 'That will purify you for looking at a demon.' And I was looking at you to see whether you had become a demon. But I can't see any. You are always my Jesus, as beautiful as an angel, as my mother tells me."
Jesus bends to kiss his cheeks, which have been slapped, saying, "They will no longer smart. I'm sorry that you had to suffer because of me."
"I'm not sorry, Lord, because those two slaps made you give me two kisses."
And he clings to his legs, hoping to receive more.
"Tell me, Mark, who was it that drove you away? Those of Lazarus' household?" asked Thaddeus.
"No, the Judeans. They come to console every day. They are so many. They stay in the house and in the garden. They come early and go away late. They behave as if they were the masters. They ill-treat everybody. Can't you see that there is nobody in the streets? The first days, people remain to watch. Then, now only children wander about to... Oh, my pitcher! My mother is waiting for water. She will give me a beating as well."
They all laugh at his distress over the prospect of further smacks. And Jesus says,
"Hurry up, then.
The fact is that I wanted to go in with you and see you work the miracle." And he concludes, "And see their faces to avenge myself for the slaps." No, that's wrong. You must not wish for revenge. You must be good and forgive. But your mother is waiting for the water.
I will go, Master. I know where Mark lives. I will tell the woman, and then join you,
says James Zebedee, running away.
They set out again slowly, and Jesus holds the delighted boy by the hand.
They are now at the garden railing. They walk along it. Many mounts are tied to it, watched by the owner's servants.
Their whispering draws the attention of some Judeans who turn towards the open gate just when Jesus sets foot on the border of the garden.
"The Master!"
exclaim the first to see him, and the word flies from group to group like the rustling of the wind.
It spreads like a wave that comes from afar and breaks on the shore as far as the walls of the house and enters it, certainly carried by the many Judeans present, or by some Pharisees, rabbis or scribes or Sadducees, scattered here and there.
Jesus advances very slowly, while people, although rushing from every direction, move away from the alley along which he is walking. As no one greets him, he does not greet anybody, as if he did not know any of the many people gathered there looking at him, with eyes full of anger and hatred, with the exception of a few who, being secret disciples, or at least righteous-hearted, even if they do not love him as Messiah, respect him as a just man. And those are Joseph, Nicodemus, John, Eleazar, and the other John the scribe, whom I saw at the multiplication of the loaves, and another John, the one who fed the people that had come down from the mountain of the Beatitudes, Gamaliel, with his son Joshua, Joachim, the Naan, the scribe, Joel of Abijah, seen at the Jordan in the episode of Sabea, Joseph Barnabas, the disciple of Gamaliel, Chuza, who looks at Jesus from afar, somewhat shy seeing him again after the mistake he had made, or perhaps fear of what people may think prevents him from approaching him as a friend. It is a fact that neither friends nor those who look at him without hatred nor enemies greet him. And Jesus does not greet anyone either. He just bowed lightly when setting foot in the alley. He has then moved straight on, as if he were a stranger to the large crowd around him. The little boy is walking beside him all the time, in his garments of a poor little peasant and barefooted, but with the bright countenance of one who is really enjoying himself, his lively dark eyes wide open to see everything and to defy everybody.
Martha comes out of the house with a group of Judean visitors, among whom there are Helkai and Zadok. With her hand, she shades her eyes, tired of weeping from the sun, as the light hurts them so that she may see where is Jesus. She sees him. She departs from those accompanying her, and she runs towards Jesus, who is at a few steps from the fountain shining in the sunshine. She throws herself at Jesus' feet after bowing to him and kisses them while bursting into tears. She says,
"Peace to you, Master."
Jesus also, as soon as she is close to him, says to her, "Peace to you." And he raises his hand to bless her, releasing the hand of the boy, who was taken by Bartholomew and held a little back. Martha goes on,
"But there is no more peace for your servant."
Still on her knees, she looks up at Jesus,
and with a cry of grief that is clearly heard in the prevailing silence, she exclaims,
"Lazarus is dead. If you had been here, he would not have died. Why did you not come sooner, Master?"
There is an unintentional tone of reproach in her question. She then reverts to the depressed tone of one who no longer has the strength to reproach, and whose only comfort is to recollect the last acts and wishes of a relative to whom one has tried to give what he wanted. And there is therefore no remorse in one's heart. And she says,
"Lazarus, our brother, has called you so much. Now see, I am grieved, and Mary is weeping. She cannot set her mind at rest, and he's no longer here. You know how much we loved him. We were hoping everything from you."
A murmur of pity for the woman and of reproach for Jesus is heard, approving the understood thought. "And you could have satisfied our request, because we deserve it for the love we have for you, whereas you have disappointed us." And the murmur passes from one group to the next one, as people shake their heads or cast derisory glances. Only the few secret disciples mingled with the crowd look compassionately at Jesus, who, pale and sad, listens to the grieved woman speaking to him. Gamaliel, his arms folded across his chest, in his wide, rich robe of very fine wool adorned with blue tassels, a little apart in a group of young men, among whom is his son and Joseph Barnabas, stares at Jesus without hatred and without love. Martha, after wiping her face, resumes,
"But even now I hope, because I know that whatever you ask of God, he will grant you."
A sorrowful, heroic profession of faith, uttered in a trembling, weeping voice, with her eyes full of anxiety, and her heart throbbing with the last hope. "Your brother will rise again. Stand up, Martha." Martha stands up, stooping out of respect before Jesus, to whom she replies,
"I know, Master, he will rise again at the resurrection on the last day."
"I am the resurrection and life. Whoever believes in me, even if he dies, will live. And whoever believes and lives in me will never die. Do you believe all that?" Jesus, who had previously spoken in a rather low voice, addressing Martha only, raises his voice when saying these sentences in which he proclaims his power of God. And its perfect timbre resounds like a golden blare in the vast garden. The people present quiver with an emotion resembling fear. Then some sneer, shaking their heads. Martha, into whom Jesus seems to wish to instill a stronger and stronger hope, by holding his hand on her shoulder, raises her lowered head. She raises it towards Jesus, staring with her sad eyes at the Christ's bright ones, and pressing her hands against her breast with a different anxiety, she replies,
"Yes, I do, my Lord. I believe all that. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, that you have come to the world, and that you can do everything you want. I believe. I'm now going to tell Mary."
And she disappears quickly into the house. Jesus remains where he was. That is, he takes a few steps forward and approaches the flower bed that surrounds the basin of the fountain. The flower bed is strewn on one side with the diamond drops of the very fine droplets of water of the jet, blown to that side by a light breeze, like silver down, and Jesus seems to be lost in contemplating the fish wriggle in the limpid water and play describing silver commas and golden reflections in the crystalline water shining in the sunshine. The Judeans are watching him. They have involuntarily divided into clearly distinct groups. On one side, in front of Jesus, all those who are hostile to him, usually separated from one another by sectarian spirit, but now concordant in opposing Jesus. Beside him, behind the apostles who have been joined by James of Zebedee, there are Joseph, Nicodemus, and others who are well disposed to him. Farther away there is Gamaliel, still in the same place and attitude and all alone, because his son and disciples have parted from him and joined the two main groups to be closer to Jesus. With her usual cry, "Rabboni!" Mary runs out of the house with her arms stretched out towards Jesus and throws herself at his feet while she kisses, sobbing deeply. Several Judeans who were in the house with her and who have followed her weep with her with doubtful sincerity. Also, Maximinus, Marcella, Sarah, Naomi have followed Mary, as well as all the servants, and their wailing is loud and high-pitched. I think that there is no one left in the house. When Martha sees Mary cry thus, she cries copiously too. "Peace to you, Mary. Stand up. Look at me. Why weep thus, like one who has no hope?" Jesus stoops to say these words in a low voice, his eyes staring at Mary's, who on her knees, relaxing on her heels, stretches her hands towards him imploringly and is unable to speak, so deep is her sobbing. "Did I not tell you to hope beyond what is credible in order to see the glory of God? Has your master perhaps changed that you are so depressed?" But Mary does not listen to the words that aim at preparing her for too great a joy after so much anguish, and being able to speak at last, she shouts, "Oh Lord, why did you not come sooner? Why did you go away from us? You knew that Lazarus was ill. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. Why did you not come? I still had to prove to him that I loved him. He should have lived. I had to show him that I persevered in honesty. I afflicted my brother so much. And now that I could have made him happy, he has been taken away from me. You could have left him with me. You could have given poor Mary the joy of comforting him after grieving him so deeply. Oh, Jesus, Jesus, my Master, my Savior, my hope." And she collapses again, her forehead on Jesus' feet, which are washed once again by her tears. And she moans, "Why have you done that, Lord? Also on account of those who hate you and are now rejoicing at what has happened. Why have you done that, Jesus?" But there is no reproach in Mary's tone as there was in Martha's. There is only the anguish of a woman who is grieved not only as a sister, but also as a disciple, who feels that the opinion of her master is diminished in the hearts of many people. Jesus, who is bent very low to hear those words whispered with her face near the ground, stands up and says in a loud voice, "Mary, do not weep. Also your master is suffering for the death of his faithful friend, for having had to let him die. Oh, how sneering and radiant with hateful joy are the faces of the enemies of Christ. They feel that he is defeated and rejoice, whilst his friends are becoming sadder and sadder. Jesus says in an even louder voice, "But I tell you, do not weep. Stand up. Look at me. Do you think that I, who loved you so much, have done this without a reason? Can you believe that I have grieved you thus in vain? Come, let us go to Lazarus. Where have you put him?" Jesus' question, rather than to Mary and Martha, who cannot speak as they are crying even louder, is addressed to all the others, and particularly to those who have come out of the house with Mary and look more upset. Perhaps they are older relatives, I do not know. And they reply to Jesus, who is clearly distressed, "Come and see." And they set out towards the place of the sepulchre, which is at the end of the orchard, where the ground is undulated and veins of calcareous rock appear on its surface. Martha, beside Jesus, who has forced Mary to stand up and is now guiding her, as she is blinded by her copious tears, points out to Jesus where Lazarus is. And when they are near the place, she also says, "It is there, Master, that your friend is buried." And she points at the stone placed across the entrance of the sepulchre. Jesus, followed by everybody, has to pass in front of Gamaliel in order to go there. But neither he nor Gamaliel greet each other. Gamaliel then joins the others, stopping with all the more rigid Pharisees a few meters from the sepulchre, while Jesus goes on, very close to it, with the two sisters, Maximinus, and those who are perhaps relatives. Jesus looks at the heavy stone placed as a door against the sepulchre, a heavy obstacle between him and his dead friend, and he weeps. The wailing of the sisters grows louder, as well as that of intimate friends and relatives. "Remove that stone," shouts Jesus all of a sudden, after wiping his tears. Everybody is surprised, and a murmur runs through the crowd that has become larger as some people of Bethany have entered the garden and have followed the guests. I can see some Pharisees touch their foreheads and shake their heads, meaning, "He's mad." No one carries out the order. Even the most faithful ones are hesitant and feel repugnance to do it. Jesus repeats his order in a louder voice, astonishing even more the people, who, urged by opposed feelings, react at first as if they wanted to run away. But immediately afterwards, they wish to draw closer to see, defying the stench of the sepulchre that Jesus once opened.
"Master, it is not possible," says Martha, striving to restrain her tears to be able to speak. "He has been down there for 4 days, and you know what disease he had. Only our love made it possible for us to cure him. By now he will certainly smell, notwithstanding the ointments. What do you want to see? His rottenness? It is not possible. Also because of the uncleanness of putrefaction and..."
"Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? Remove that stone. I want it."
It is the cry of divine will. A subdued "Oh!" is uttered by every mouth. Faces grow pale. Some people shiver as if an icy wind of death had blown over everybody. Martha nods to Maximinus, who orders the servants to get the necessary tools to remove the heavy stone. The servants run away and come back with picks and sturdy levers. And they work, inserting the points of the shining picks between the rock and the stone, and then replacing the picks with the sturdy levers and finally lifting the stone carefully, letting it slide to one side and dragging it cautiously against the rocky wall. An infected stench comes out of the dark hole, making everyone withdraw. Martha asks in a low voice, "Master, do you want to go down there? If you do, torches will be required." But she is wan at the thought of having to go down. Jesus does not reply to her. He raises his eyes to the sky. He stretches out his arms crosswise and prays in a very loud voice, syllabizing the words, "Father, I thank you for hearing me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said so for those who are present here, for the people surrounding me, that they may believe in you, in me, and that you have sent me." He remains thus for a moment, and he becomes so transfigured that he seems to be enraptured, while without uttering any sound, he says more secret words of prayer or adoration. I do not know. What I know is that he is so transhumanized that it is not possible to look at him without feeling one's heart quiver. His body seems to become light, spiritualized, rising in height and also from the earth. Although the shades of his hair, eyes, complexion, and garments remain unchanged, contrary to what happened during the transfiguration on Mount Tabor, when everything became light and dazzling brightness, he seems to shed light, and that his whole body becomes light. Light seems to form a halo around him, particularly around his face raised to the sky, certainly enraptured in the contemplation of his Father. He remains thus for some time. Then he becomes himself, the man, but powerfully majestic. He proceeds as far as the threshold of the sepulchre. He moves his arms forward. So far he had held them crosswise, the palms turned upwards. Now, with palms turned downwards, so that his hands are already inside the hole of the sepulchre, and their whiteness is outstanding in the darkness of the hole. His blue eyes are blazing, and their flash, forecasting a miracle, is today unsustainable in the silent darkness, and in a powerful voice, and with a cry louder than the one he uttered on the lake when he ordered the wind to abate, in a voice that I never heard in any other miracle, he shouts, "Lazarus, come out!" His voice is echoed by the sepulchral cave, and coming out of it, it spreads all over the garden. It is repeated by the undulations of the ground of Bethany. I think it travels as far as the first hills beyond the fields, and then comes back, repeated and subdued, like an order that cannot fail. It is certain that from numberless directions one can hear again, "Out, out, out." Everybody is thrilled with emotion, and if curiosity rivets everyone in his place, faces grow pale and eyes are opened wide while mouths are closed involuntarily with cries of surprise already on their lips. Martha, a little behind and to one side, seems fascinated looking at Jesus. Mary, who has never moved away from the Master, falls on her knees at the entrance of the sepulchre, one hand on her breast to check her throbbing heart, the other holding the edge of Jesus' mantle unconsciously and convulsively, and one realizes that she is trembling because the mantle is shaken lightly by the hand holding it. Something white seems to emerge from the deep end of the sepulchre. At first, it is just a short convex line. Then it becomes oval-shaped. Then wider and longer lines appear. And the dead body, enveloped in its bandages, comes slowly forward, becoming more visible, more mysterious, and more awful. Jesus draws back imperceptibly, but continuously, as the other moves forward. Thus the distance between the two is always the same. Mary is compelled to drop the edge of the mantle, but she does not move from where she is. Joy, emotion, everything nail her to the place where she is. And, "Oh!" is uttered more and more clearly by the lips previously closed by the anxiety of suspense. From a whisper hardly distinguishable, it changes into a voice. From a voice into a powerful cry. Lazarus is by now on the threshold of the sepulchre, and he remains there, rigid and silent, like a plaster statue, just rough-hewed, thus shapeless, a long thing, thin at the head and legs, thicker at the trunk, as macabre as death itself, ghost-like in the white bandages against the dark background of the sepulchre. As the sun shines on him, putrid matter can be seen dripping already here and there from the bandages. Jesus shouts out in a loud voice, "Unbind him and let him go. Give him clothes and food." "Master," says Martha, and perhaps she would like to say more, but Jesus stares at her, subduing her with his bright eyes, and he says, "Here, at once, bring a garment, dress him in the presence of all the people, and give him something to eat." He orders and never turns round to look at those who are behind and around him. He looks only at Lazarus, at Mary who is near her resurrected brother, heedless of the disgust caused to everybody by the putrid bandages, and at Martha, who is panting as if she felt her heart break and does not know whether she should shout for joy or weep. The servants rush to carry out the instructions. Naomi is the first to run away and to come back with garments folded on her arm. Some untie the bandages after rolling up their sleeves and tucking up their garments so that they may not touch the dripping rot. Marcella and Sarah come back with amphoras of perfumes, followed by servants carrying basins and jugs of water, steaming hot, or trays with cups of milk, wine, fruit, and honey cakes. The very long, narrow bandages, which I think are of linen, with salvage on each side, obviously woven for that purpose, unroll like rolls of tape from a reel and pile up on the ground, heavy with spices and pus. The servants move them to one side by means of sticks. They have started from the head, but even there is matter that has certainly dripped from the nose, ears, and mouth. The sudarium placed on the face is soaked with putrid matter, and Lazarus's face, which is very pale and emaciated, with his eyes closed with the pomade placed in the eye sockets, with his hair and thin short beard sticking together, is soiled with it. The shroud placed round his body falls off slowly as the bandages are removed, freeing the trunk that they had enveloped for days, restoring a human figure to what they had previously transformed into something like a huge chrysalid. The bony shoulders, the emaciated arms, the ribs just covered with skin. The sunken stomach began to appear slowly. And as the bandages fall off, the sisters, Maximinus, the servants busy themselves removing the first layer of dirt and bombs, and they insist continuously changing the water, made detergent with spices, until the skin appears clean. When they uncover Lazarus's face, and he can look, he directs his gaze towards Jesus before looking at his sisters. And he seems absent-minded and does not pay attention to what is happening while he looks at his Jesus with a loving smile on his lips and tears shining in his deep sunken eyes. Jesus also smiles at him, his eyes shining with tears. And without speaking, he directs Lazarus's gaze towards the sky. Lazarus understands and moves his lips in silent prayer. Martha thinks that he wishes to say something, but has no voice yet, and she asks, "What are you saying to me, my Lazarus?"
"Nothing, Martha. I was thanking the Most High."
His pronunciation is steady, his voice loud. The crowds utter an "Oh!" of amazement once again. He has now been freed and cleaned down to his sides, and they can put on him his short tunic, a kind of a short shirt that reaches below his enguin, falling on his thighs. They make him sit down to untie his legs and wash them. As soon as they appear, Martha and Mary utter a loud cry, pointing to the legs and bandages. And whilst on the bandages tied round the legs and on the shroud placed under the bandages, the putrid matter is so copious as to stream down the cloth. The legs are completely healed. Only red cyanotic scars indicate the parts affected by gangrene. All the people shout their amazement more loudly. Jesus smiles, and Lazarus smiles too, looking for a moment at his healed legs. Then he becomes engrossed again in looking at Jesus. He never seems to gratify his desire to see him. The Judeans, Pharisees, Sadducees, scribes, rabbis come forward cautiously in order not to contaminate their garments. They examine Lazarus closely. They examine Jesus closely. But neither Lazarus nor Jesus minds them. They look at each other, and all the rest means nothing to them. They now put sandals on Lazarus's feet, and he stands up, agile and steady. He takes the tunic that Martha hands him. He puts it on by himself. He fastens his belt and adjusts the fold of the garment. And there he is, lean and pale, but like everybody else. He washes again, his hands and arms as far as his elbows, after tucking up his sleeves. And with clean water, he washes his face and head again, until he feels that he is thoroughly clean. He dries his hair and face, hands the towel to the servant, and goes straight towards Jesus. He prostrates himself. He kisses his feet. Jesus bends, lifts him up, presses him to his heart, saying, "Welcome back home, my dear friend. May peace and joy be with you. Live to accomplish your happy destiny. Raise your face that I may greet you with a kiss." And he kisses Lazarus's cheeks and is kissed by him. Only after worshiping and kissing the Master, Lazarus speaks to his sisters and kisses them. He then kisses Maximinus and Naomi, who are weeping for joy, and some of those who I think are related to the family or are very close friends. He then kisses Joseph, Nicodemus, Simon Zealot, and a few more. Jesus goes personally towards a servant who is carrying a tray on which there is some food, and he takes a honey cake, an apple, a goblet of wine, and he offers them to Lazarus after offering and blessing them, so that he may nourish himself. And Lazarus eats with the healthy appetite of one who is well. A further "oh!" of amazement is uttered by the crowd. Jesus seems to see no one but Lazarus. But, in actual fact, he observes everything and everybody. And when he sees with what furious gesture Sadoc, Helki, Hananiah, Felix, Doris, and Cornelius and others are about to go away, he says in a loud voice,
"Wait a moment, Sadoc. I want to have a word with you and your friends." They stop with the sinister look of criminals. Joseph of Arimathea makes a gesture as if he were frightened and beckons to the zealot to restrain Jesus. But he is already going towards the rancorous group and is already saying loud, "Sadoc, is what you have seen enough for you? One day you told me that in order to believe, you and your peers needed to see a decomposed dead body be recomposed and in good health. Are you satisfied with the rottenness you have seen? Can you admit that Lazarus was dead and that now he is alive and healthy, as he has never been for many years? I know, you came here to tempt these people, to increase their grief and their doubt. You came here looking for me, hoping to find me hiding in the room of the dying man. You did not come with feelings of love and with a desire to honor the deceased man, but to ensure that Lazarus was really dead. And you have continued to come, rejoicing all the more as time went by. If the situation had evolved as you were hoping, as you believed it would evolve, you would have been right in exulting. The friend who cures everybody but does not cure his friend. The master who rewards everybody's faith, but not the faith of his friends in Bethany. The Messiah, powerless against the reality of death. That is what was making you exult. Then God gave you his reply. No prophet had ever been able to put together what was decomposed, in addition to being dead. God did it. That is the living witness of what I am. One day it was God who took some dust and made it into a form, and he breathed the vital spirit into it, and man was. I was there to say, "Let man be made in our own image and likeness," because I am the Word of the Father. Today I, the Word, said to what is even less than dust, I said to rottenness, "Live," and decomposition was recomposed into flesh, into wholesome, living, breathing flesh. There it is, looking at you. And to the flesh I joined the spirit that had been lying for days in Abraham's bosom. I called him with my will, because I can do everything, as I am the living being, the King of kings, to whom all creatures and things are subject. What are you going to reply to me now? He is in front of them, tall, ablaze with majesty, really judge and God. They do not reply.
He insists, "Is it not yet enough for you to believe, to accept what is ineluctable? You have kept but one part of your promise. This is not the sign of Jonah," says Sadoc harshly. "You shall have that one as well. I promised it, and I will keep my promise," says the Lord. "And another person who is present here and is waiting for another sign shall have it. And as he is a just man, he will accept it. You will not. You will remain what you are. He turns round and sees Simon, the member of the Sanhedrin, the son of Eliana. He gazes at him. He leaves the previous group, and when he is face to face with him, he says in a low but incisive voice, "You are fortunate that Lazarus does not remember his stay among the dead. What have you done with your father, O Cain?" Simon runs away with a cry of fear that he changes into a howl of malediction. "May you be cursed, Nazarene!" To which Jesus replies, "Your curse is rising to heaven, and from heaven the Most High throws it back at you. You are marked with the sign, you wretch." He goes back to the groups that are astonished, almost frightened. He meets Gamaliel, who is going towards the road. He looks at Gamaliel, who looks at him. Jesus says to him without stopping, "Be ready, Rabbi. The sign will come soon. I never lie." The garden slowly becomes empty. The Judeans are dumbfounded, but most of them are bursting with wrath. If glances could reduce one to ashes, Jesus would have been pulverized a long time ago. They speak and discuss among themselves while going away, and they are so upset by their defeat that they are unable to conceal the purpose of their presence here under the hypocritical appearance of friendship. They go away without saying goodbye to Lazarus or to the sisters. Some remain behind, as they have been conquered to the Lord by the miracle. Among them there is Joseph Barnabas, who throws himself on his knees before Jesus, worshiping him. Another one is Joel of Abijah, the scribe, who does the same thing before departing. And there are others as well, whom I don't know, but they must be influential people. In the meantime, Lazarus, surrounded by his more intimates, has withdrawn into the house. Joseph, Nicodemus, and other good people greet Jesus and go away. The Judeans who were staying with Martha and Mary depart, giving low bows. The servants close the gate. The house becomes peaceful again. Jesus looks about himself. He sees smoke and flames at the end of the garden towards the sepulchre. All alone, standing in the middle of a path, Jesus says, "Rottenness that is being destroyed by fire. The rottenness of death, but no fire will ever destroy the corruption of hearts. Of those hearts. Not even the fire of hell. It will last forever. How horrible. Worse than death. Worse than putrefaction. And, but who will save you, O mankind, if you love so much to be corrupt? You want to be corrupt. And I've torn a man from his sepulchre with one word. And with a multitude of words and a multitude of sorrows, I shall not be able to tear away from sin man. Men. Millions of men." He sits down, and with his hands he covers his face dejectedly. A servant who is passing by sees him. He goes into the house. Shortly afterwards, Mary comes out. She goes towards Jesus, walking so lightly that she does not seem to be touching the ground. She approaches him and says in a low voice, "Rabboni, you are tired." "Come, my lord, your tired apostles have gone to the other house, except Simon the Zealot." "Are you weeping, master? Why?" She kneels at Jesus' feet. She watches him. Jesus looks at her. He does not reply. He stands up and directs his steps towards the house, followed by Mary. They go into one of the halls. Lazarus is not there, neither is the zealot. But Martha's there. She's happy, transfigured by joy. She turns towards Jesus, explaining, "Lazarus has gone to the bathroom to purify himself further. Oh, Master, Master, what shall I tell you?" She adores him with her whole being. She becomes aware of Jesus' sadness and says, "Are you sad, Lord? Are you not happy that Lazarus?" She becomes suspicious. "Oh, you are grave with me. I have sinned, it is true."
"We have sinned, sister," says Mary.
"No, you did not." "Oh, Master, Mary did not sin. Mary obeyed. I only disobeyed. I sent for you, because I could no longer bear their insinuations that you were not the Messiah, the Lord. And I could no longer put up with all that suffering. Lazarus was so anxious to have you. He called you so much. Forgive me, Jesus."
"Are you not saying anything, Mary?" asks Jesus.
"Master, I suffered then only as a woman. I suffered because..." "Martha, swear here before the Master that you will never tell Lazarus of his frenzy." "My Master, I have known you completely, O divine mercy, during Lazarus's last hours. Oh, my God, how much you have loved me, as you have forgiven me. You God, you pure, you... If my brother, who does love me but is a man, only a man, has not forgiven me everything from the bottom of his heart, no, I am wrong. He has not forgiven my past, and when his weakness on the point of death blunted his goodness, which I thought was oblivion of the past, he shouted his grief and his indignation against me. Oh!" Mary weeps. "Do not weep, Mary. God has forgiven you and has forgotten. Lazarus' soul has also forgiven and forgotten. It wanted to forget. The man has not been able to forget everything. And when the flesh overwhelmed the weakened will with its last pangs, the man spoke." "I am not indignant at it, Lord. It helped me to love you more and to love Lazarus more. But it was from that moment that I also wished to have you here, because it was too distressing to think that Lazarus should die without peace through my fault. And later, when I heard the Judeans deride you, when I saw that you were not coming even after his death, not even after I had obeyed you, hoping beyond what is credible, hoping till the moment when the sepulchre was opened to receive him, then my spirit suffered. Lord, if I had anything to expiate, and I certainly had it, I did expiate." "Poor Mary, I know your heart. You deserved the miracle, and let that confirm you in hoping and believing." "My Master, I will always hope and believe now. I will never doubt again, Lord. I will live on faith. You have enabled me to believe what is unbelievable." "And what about you, Martha? Have you learned?"
"No, not yet. You are my Martha, but you are not yet my perfect worshiper."
"Why do you act, and you do not contemplate? It is holier. See, your strength, as it is too inclined towards earthly things,
yielded to the ascertainment of earthly matters that at times seem without remedy. In actual fact, earthly matters are without remedy, unless God intervenes. That is why human creatures must be able to believe and contemplate and love to the utmost power of their whole being, with thought, soul, flesh, blood. I repeat, with all the strength of man. I want you to be strong, Martha. I want you to be perfect. You did not obey because you did not believe and hope completely. And you did not believe and hope because you did not love absolutely. But I absolve you. I forgive you, Martha. I raised Lazarus today. I will now give you a stronger heart. I gave him life. I will instill into you the strength to love, believe, and hope perfectly. Be happy now. And in peace. Forgive those who offended you in the past days. Lord, I have sinned against that. Not long ago I said to old Hananiah, who had sneered at you in previous days, "Who has triumphed, you or God? Your mockery or my faith? Christ is the living being and the truth. I knew that his glory would shine more brightly, and you, old man, make yourself a new soul if you do not want to know what death is." You spoke the truth, but do not contend with the wicked, Mary. And forgive, forgive if you want to imitate me. Here's Lazarus, I can hear his voice. Lazarus, in fact, comes in, wearing fresh clothes and clean-shaven, his hair dressed and scented. Maximinus and the zealot are with him. "Master!" Lazarus kneels down, once again worshiping. Jesus lays a hand on his head and smiles, saying, "The test is over, my friend, for you and for your sisters. Be happy and strong now in serving the Lord. What do you remember, my friend, of the past? I mean of your last hours?" "A great desire to see you, and a great peace in the love of my sisters." "What did you regret most to leave dying?" "You, Lord, and my sisters. You, because I would not have been able to serve you. Them, because they have given me every joy." "Oh, my brother," says Mary with a sigh. "You more than Martha. You have given me Jesus and the measure of what is Jesus, and Jesus has given you to me. You are the gift of God, Mary." "You said so also when you were dying," says Mary, and she scrutinizes her brother's face. "Because it is my constant thought. But I have grieved you so deeply. Also my disease was painful. But through it I hope I have expiated the faults of old Lazarus, and that I have risen purified to be worthy of God. You and I, the two who have risen again to serve the Lord, and Martha between us, as she has always been the peace of the house." Do you hear that, Mary? Lazarus is speaking words of wisdom and truth. I will now withdraw and leave you to your joy. "No, Lord, stay here with us. Stay in Bethany and in my house. It will be lovely." "I will stay. I want to make up for what you have suffered." "Martha, do not be sad. Martha thinks that she has grieved me. But my grief is not brought about by you, but by those who do not want to be redeemed. They hate more and more. Their hearts are poisoned. Well, let us forgive. Let us forgive, Lord," says Lazarus with his mild smile. And it all ends on that word. Jesus says, I could have intervened in time to prevent Lazarus' death. But I did not want to do that. I knew that his resurrection would be a double-edged weapon, because it would convert the righteous-minded Judeans and would make the non-righteous-minded ones even more rancorous. The latter, because of this final blow of my power, would sentence me to death. But I had come for that, and it was now time that that should be accomplished. I could have gone at once, but I needed to convince the most stubborn, incredulous people by means of a resurrection from advanced rottenness, and also my apostles, destined to spread my faith in the world, needed a faith supported by miracles of the first magnitude. There was so much humanity in the apostles. I've already said so. It was not an insurmountable obstacle. On the contrary, it was a logical consequence of their condition of men called to be my apostles when they were already grown up. The mentality, the frame of mind of a person cannot be changed between one day and the next one. And in my wisdom, I did not want to choose and educate children, bringing them up according to my thought, to make them my apostles. I could have done that, but I did not want to, lest souls should reproach me for despising those who are not innocent, and should justify themselves with the excuse that I also had made it clear that those whose characters are already formed cannot change. No, everything can be changed if one is willing. In fact, I turned cowardly, quarrelsome, usurious, sensual, incredulous people into martyrs, saints, and evangelizers of the world. Only those who did not want did not change. I loved and still love little and weak people. You are an example, providing they are willing to love and follow me. And I turn such non-entities into my favorites, my friends, my ministers. I still make use of them, and they are a continuous miracle that I work to lead others to believe in me, and not to kill the possibility of miracles. How languishing that possibility is at present. Like a lamp lacking oil, it is in the throes of death and it dies, killed by the scanty or lacking faith in the God of miracles. There are two forms of insistence in requesting a miracle. God yields to one with love. He turns his back disdainfully to the other. The former asks, as I taught to ask, without lack of confidence and without tiredness, and does not admit that God may not grant the request, because God is good, and who is good grants, because God is powerful and can do everything. That is love, and God hears those who love. The latter is the overbearingness of rebels who want God to be their servant and to lower himself to their wickedness, and to give them what they do not give him, love and obedience. This form is an offense that God punishes by denying his graces. You complain that I no longer work collective miracles. How could I work them? Where are the communities that believe in me? Where are the true believers? How many true believers are there in a community? Like surviving flowers in a wood burnt by a fire, I can see a believing spirit now and again. Satan has burnt the rest with his doctrines, and he will burn them more and more. I beg you to bear in mind my reply to Thomas as a supernatural rule for yourselves. It is not possible to be my true disciples if one cannot give human life the importance it deserves, a means to conquer the true life, not an aim. He who wants to save his life in this world will lose eternal life. I've told you, and I repeat it. What are trials? Passing clouds. Heaven remains and is waiting for you after the trial. I conquered heaven for you through my heroism. You must imitate me. Heroism is not laid aside exclusively for those who are to suffer martyrdom. Christian life is perpetual heroism because it is a perpetual struggle against the world, the demon, and the flesh. I do not compel you to follow me. I leave you free. But I do not want you to be hypocrites, either with me and like me, or against me. You cannot deceive me. No, I cannot be deceived, and I do not form alliances with the enemy. If you prefer him to me, you cannot think that you can have me as your friend at the same time. Either him or me, make your choice. Martha's grief is different from Mary's because of the different psyche of the two sisters and because of their different behavior. Happy are those who behave in such a way as to have no remorse for grieving one who is now dead and can no longer be comforted for the sorrow caused to him. But how much happier is he who has no remorse for grieving his God, me, Jesus, and is not afraid of the day he will have to meet me. On the contrary, he pines for it, as for a joy anxiously dreamt of for a whole lifetime and at long last achieved. I'm your father, brother, and friend. So why do you offend me so often? Do you know how long you still have to live? To live in order to make amends? No, you do not know that. So act righteously, hour by hour, day by day. Always righteously. You will always make me happy. And even if sorrow comes to you, because sorrow is sanctification, it is the myrrh that preserves you from the putridity of sensuality. You will always be certain that I love you, and that I love you also in that grief. And you will always have the peace that comes from my love. You, my little John, know whether I can comfort one also in grief. In my prayer to the Father, there is repeated what I said at the beginning. It was necessary to rouse the opacity of the Judeans and of the world in general by means of a main miracle. And the resurrection of a man who had been buried 4 days and had gone down into the tomb after a long, chronic, disgusting, well-known disease is not an event that can leave people indifferent or doubtful. If I had cured him while he was alive, or if I had infused the spirit into him as soon as he had breathed his last, the acridity of enemies might have raised doubts on the entity of the miracle. But the stench of the corpse, the putrefaction of the bandages, the long period in the sepulchre left no doubts. And a miracle in the miracle. I wanted Lazarus to be freed and cleaned in the presence of everybody so that they could see that not only life, but also the wholesomeness of the limbs had been restored where previously the ulcerated flesh had spread the germs of death in the blood. When I grant a grace, I always give more than what you ask for. I wept before Lazarus's tomb. And many names have been given to my tears. In the meantime, you must bear in mind that graces are obtained through grief mixed with unfaltering faith in the Eternal Father. I wept not so much because of the loss of my friend and because of the sorrow of the sisters, as because three thoughts that had always pierced my heart like three sharp nails surfaced then. More lively than ever, like depths stirred up. The ascertainment of the ruin that Satan had brought to man by seducing him to evil,
a ruin the human punishment of which was sorrow and death, physical death, the symbol and living metaphor of spiritual death that sin causes to the soul, hurling it into infernal darkness, whereas it was destined, like a queen, to live in the kingdom of light. The persuasion that not even this miracle worked almost as a sublime corollary to 3 years of evangelization would convince the Judaic world of the truth of which I was the bearer, and that no miracle would in future convert the world to Christ. Oh, how grievous it was to be so close to death for so few. The mental vision of my imminent death. I was God, but I was also man. And to be the Redeemer, I was to feel the weight of expiation. Therefore, the horror of death, and of such a death. I was a living, healthy being who was saying to himself, I shall soon be dead. I shall be in a sepulcher like Lazarus. Soon the most dreadful agony will be my companion. I must die. God's kindness spares you the knowledge of the future. But I was not spared it. Oh, believe me, you who complain of your destiny, none was more sad than mine, because I always clearly foresaw everything that was to happen to me. Joined to the poverty, the hardships, the bitterness that accompanied me from my birth to my death. So do not complain, and hope in me. I give you my peace. Marginal notes on Lazarus's resurrection and in connection with a sentence of St. John. Jesus says, in the Gospel of John, as it has now been read for ages, there is written, Jesus had not yet come into the village of Bethany. To avoid possible objections, I wish to point out that with regard to this sentence and the one of the work, which states that I met Martha a few steps away from the fountain in Lazarus's garden, there is no contradiction of events, but only a discrepancy of translation and description. 3/4 of the village of Bethany belonged to Lazarus. Likewise, a large part of Jerusalem belonged to him. But let us speak of Bethany. As 3/4 of it belonged to Lazarus, one could say, Bethany of Lazarus. So the text would not be wrong even if I had met Martha in the village or at the fountain, as some people wish to say. In actual fact, I had not gone into the village to prevent the people of Bethany, who were all hostile to the members of the Sanhedrin, from rushing towards me. I had gone round the back of Bethany to reach Lazarus's house, which was at the opposite end with respect to one who entered Bethany coming from En-Shemesh. So John rightly says that I had not yet entered the village. And equally right is little John, who says that I had stopped near the basin, fountain for the Jews, already in Lazarus's garden, but still very far from the house. One should also consider that during the period of mourning and uncleanness, it was not yet the 7th day after Lazarus's death, his sisters did not leave the house. So the meeting took place within the enclosure of their property. Note that little John states that the people of Bethany came into the garden only when I had ordered the stone to be removed. Previously, the people of Bethany did not know that I was in Bethany, and only when the news was spread, they rushed to Lazarus's house.